Welcome to the audio library of Jumping Turtle. We are pleased to bring you A Determined Soul, Finding Laughter in Trials, a talk by Hank Smith. This presentation was recorded live during the Keep On Rolling conference. We hope that you enjoy it.
Yeah, he did. I didn't want to do that. Thank you so much. Thank you. That was really nice. I've never been. That happens in my house every morning. Right. Welcome to breakfast. And now I'll get set up in here. Thank you so much for coming. This means a lot to us that you would come here. Meg and John and I and Mark is our new addition last year. We put this together hoping people will come. Hoping people will want to, you know, come and feel inspired and you know, have a day together. So some of you came because you wanted to. Others of you came because you were, you know, someone forced you to by gunpoint. But either way, you know, Mom was like, get in the van. It's going to be fun. Yeah, get in the van. All right. So let's have a great time. Now, I was talking to some of you might know who Topher Clark is. He's a big name here at UVU. He's in the theater department, and we talked about the difference between audiences who watch movies and audiences who watch plays. He's in the theater, and the same thing for a speaker is that when you go to a speaker, you think it's like a movie where you just sit there and do nothing, you have a bad experience, right? Because the actors on the screen in the movie, they don't know that you're watching, or they don't know if you're having a good time or not, right? It has nothing to do with the way they perform or the way they speak. But when you have a live audience, it totally makes a difference. So when throughout the day today, if you like something that John or Meg says, you need to smile, all right? Practice. See, look at that. Ah, you're so much more attractive when you smile. Some kids talk to me, they're like, "Brother, Dr. Smith, how come I don't have any friends?" I'm like, "Well, because you look like you're gonna kill someone. You need to smile," right? So smile and laugh and be loud and clap and the better audience members are those that you can tell are having a really good time. So today, most people when they come to this conference, they come to see John and they leave talking about Meg, and I'm the other guy, and I have no problem with being the other guy. I have no problem with it at all. But we are going to talk a little bit about trials. Meg is going to talk about trials that happened to her because life happened to her, and she's going to show you what you do when those type of trials come. I don't have a lot of those trials. Most of the trials, anybody have the feeling that God looks at you and says, "I was going to give you trials, but you do a pretty good job of making your own," and so I'll just kind of be hands off here and let you do your thing. That's pretty much my life. Anybody ever make their own trial? Anybody ever make their own difficulty? I do all this all the time. Anybody make their own trial and now they live with them in their house with them? Anybody have some of those? I have five of these that live in my house with me. Let me show you number four and five. Here they are together. They came on the same day. We wanted a baby girl, and we went to the doctor, and he said, "It's not a baby girl." And I said, "It's a baby boy." And he said, "Sort of." He said, "It's two boys." Here's another one of them. Right here. That one on the right, his face should change more than it does. But there is something a little wrong with him. We're not quite sure. I was asking the doctors, I was like, "Is that face going to change?" And they're like, "You know what, we don't know." And it didn't. 7 months later, this is 7 months later, we took a picture, and this is what we got. Yeah, you laugh because it's not your child, huh? It's fun having odd-looking children. Anybody have odd-looking children? Anybody have them sitting here? You want to point them out? Anybody have odd-looking kids? Halloween is easy with an odd-looking kid. You know exactly who he's going to be without question, right? Little blue food coloring in his Halloween costume. His Halloween costume was done. Now, having twins is fun. They do funny things all the time that make you laugh. Do we have any moms here of twins or multiples, twins or triplets or more? Oh, we are in a special club. Let me see them. One, two. Where are you over here? Three, four. Anybody else? One, two, three, four. Oh, we are in a special club. Those of you who don't have twins or multiples, can I just give you some pieces of advice? Because you bother us without knowing it. And so I'm going to help you. Here's the first thing you do that bothers. Now, the reason we get bothered is because we're not sleeping. And you're pushing two babies with the exact same face, with the exact same clothes. And you, who we love, because you're our friends and neighbors, you come up and you ask, you have degrees. You speak many languages. You are a great person. You look at two babies with the exact same face and the exact same clothes, and you ask, all of you ask the exact same question, are those twins? And mom, where are you again? Where's my two over here? Where's my two? And where's my two? All right? And one up here. We're always nice about it. Right? We're always nice about it. We're like, yes. But inside, we're thinking, what else could they possibly be? Please, please, go ahead. Give me another plausible explanation. Go ahead. Go ahead. We found this one. Looked just like this one, so we took it. Of course they're twins. Of course they're twins. And then you all say the same thing, which we love if we weren't so tired. Or you can always tell, by the way, you can always tell people who have twins because they walk right by you and they say, it gets better, and they just keep going because they know you have no time to talk. But other people say, they say something like, I always wanted twins. Did you? That's cute. Because at the time, you don't want twins. Don't get me wrong, you love your kids, but you just wish they came separately because you're not sleeping at all. And so it really, it's like walking up to someone being like, oh, you have diabetes? I wish I had diabetes. Do you? That's cute. And then they all say the same thing. Where are they again? Five of you here? They all say the same thing. Well, looks like you have your hands full. Does it? And we're just nice about it. We say, yeah, we have our hands full. But on the inside, you're like, why are you talking to me then? If it looks like I have my hands full, why are you talking to me? Why are you asking me pointless questions and stating the obvious? Don't do that. So from here on out, when you see people with twins, just walk by and be like, hi, and then just keep going because we're super tired. Now, they're slowly getting older, and kids have a tendency to create problems and messes as they get older. These two like the sounds of they liked the sound of eggs dropping on the floor. That's their favorite sound. And it's even funnier when you have a brother that laughs at you, who thinks it's even, you know, who eggs you on. Do you like that? When these moments come, when these difficulties come and you think, why did we do this to ourselves? What happened? I want you to remember a story. This is a story that I've told often. I really like it. I can't remember where I found it, but I like it. It says, a wise woman, come on, as if there was any other kind. A wise woman who was traveling in the mountains found a precious stone in a stream that she knew was very valuable. The next day, she met a traveler who was hungry, and the woman opened her bag to share her food. The hungry traveler saw the precious stone and asked the woman to give it to him, and she did so without hesitation. The next day, the hungry traveler, he left rejoicing in his good fortune. He knew that the stone was going to give him enough. He never had to work again. But he came back the next day to return the stone to the woman. I've been thinking, he said, I know how valuable this stone is, but I'm going to give it back in the hopes that you can give me something more precious. Now, I was with a group of teenagers once, and I said, what does she have? What does she have that's more precious? And they're like, friendship. No. Ask any adult here, friendship, I can get new friends, right? For that much money, I could get new friends. I'd be okay. It's not friendship. What's the answer? He then asks the woman, can you give me what you have within you that enabled you to give me that stone? Right, or in other words, can you give me what you are? Can you give me what you are? How did you become who you are? I like this story because we're going to talk about two different types of happiness first. The happiness that happens to us, right? And there's awesome things that happen to us. I got a promotion. I won a prize, right? Someone asked me out. There's happiness that happens to me. And then there's happiness that happens where? You can speak. Yeah, there's happiness that happens inside of me. There's something that happens inside of me that changes who I am. Let me give you the best example I could find. And that is, in the 1970s, there was a study done. This was a well-done study. It wasn't a CNN click poll. It was a real study. It took a couple of years. And they interviewed two groups of people. They wanted to know who was happier, lottery winners or paraplegics, people who had gotten some sort of accident like Meg, and had, you know, this major tragedy and lost the use of their legs. So they went and interviewed them for years to find out who was happier. Now, it seems pretty obvious, doesn't it? If I were to ask you on your way home from our conference today, you could have one of two of these things happen to you. Which one would you choose? Right? None of you are like, well, let me give me a second. No, all of us, of course, I'll take the money. Unless you're one of these weird people, it's like, no, Dr. Smith, some of our greatest trials can be prosperity. Okay. I like my trials in cash too. Come on. All of us would take the money, right? But here is what they found. Happiness 1 year after the event is the exact same. The exact same. Now some of you are like, that's not true. That, how can that be true? You think if I won the lottery, I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life, right? Or if you've lost the use of your legs, you thought, I'm never going to be happy again. How could I ever be happy again? But apparently happiness is not tied to your circumstances. According to the research, happiness is tied to something else, but not your circumstances. Take a look. What about stuff? Is happiness tied to stuff? Here is happiness in the United States over the last 50 years. Now, what has been invented in the last 50 years that should have made us happier? You can talk to me. What has been invented? Microwaves. Cell phones. Remote control. Oh, right? Kids don't even remember the day when the phone used to be attached to the house, right? And you had to stand up to change the channel. Who had to stand up to change the channel? Who here remembers that, right? Happiness should have flown off the handle when that was invented. But yeah, what's happened in the United States over the last 50 years? Happiness has generally done what? Decreased, stayed about relatively the same over the last 50 years. So apparently it's not tied to circumstance and it's not tied to stuff. Well, where is happiness found then? I've been trying to convince people of this for a long time. The idea of happiness and money are not connected after a certain point. Did you know if you take someone out of poverty, it really changes their happiness level. It really does. So if someone's making below poverty level and you can give them an education or something and bring them out of that poverty level, their happiness really dramatically increases until about the point of about right now in the research, it's about $75,000 a year. As soon as someone makes about $75,000 a year, guess what adding more money does to their happiness? Nothing. I know some of you are like, nothing. You're telling me the guy who makes $4 million a year and the guy who makes $75,000 a year have the exact same level of happiness? And the answer is, yep. I know there's some people here that that's not true. One lady yelled out at me. She was like, those people just don't know where to shop. Okay. One lady, she even came up to me afterwards. She was so upset by this. She was like, are you telling me that if you gave me more $1 million more a year, I would not be happier? That's what the research shows. She's like, I would be unhappy in some really nice places. Isn't that interesting? You'd think. How many of you have fallen into the trap, if I had more money, I would be happier? Come on, raise your hand if it's ever happened to you. If I had more money, I would be happier. We do this all the time. If things were different, then I would be happier. But it's simply, according to all the science, right? It is absolutely, absolutely not true. Oh, I wish it was. Take a look at this pie chart right here. This is an interesting pie chart. This is something that most scientists haven't even tried to change in the last 20 years because it's pretty much set. The hypothesis is pretty set. That 50% of your happiness comes from your DNA, right? Anybody here just generally happy? Just you wake up happy, you go to bed happy. Who's that? You should thank your parents because your parents gave you good DNA. If it doesn't happen to you, you can talk to the therapist about your parents, but either way, they have a pretty big impact on the way you feel. 40% of your happiness comes from intentional activities. Intentional activities are like exercise is a big one. Exercise is the second most important intentional activity for increasing your happiness. By the way, it has nothing to do with body weight, body shape, or body size. It has nothing to do with that. People are generally who exercise are happier. Guess what number one is? Anybody know? It's meditation. Isn't that fascinating? The number one correlated thing with happiness is meditation, intentional activities. Others include surrounding yourselves with happy people. Look on your left and on your right. Are those happy people? Because if they are, you are more likely going to be happy. Now, I'm not asking you to get rid of unhappy people in your life, all right? Because some of them live in your house and you gave birth to them. However, you might want to add some happy people to your social circle because it has a really big difference. Did you know that happy people spend more money on other people than on themselves? Right? Dads know about this, right? Happy people spend more money on other people than themselves. Happy people spend more time outside than people who are unhappy. Did you know that? How many of you spend a lot of time outside? you spend a lot of time outside. It, in general, it has a better effect on your happiness. In fact, this was a sad study. I laughed pretty hard. I shouldn't have. But they took people recovering from surgery and put them either in a room without a window or a room that faced a brick wall. I was like, how sad. And then they took people and took them outside every day and had their window face a park, right? The people in the room without a window or the brick wall, they were in the hospital longer, they needed more medication and had more complications. No difference other than just the window and going outside had a supreme effect on their happiness. Do you know that happy people listen to what they would refer to as happy music that makes them happy? Who does this already? Listens to music that makes them happy, right? You already do this. There is a lot that has to do with intentional activity. The one that people hate is the small little red piece of pie right there, which is your circumstances. The things that are outside of your control. Because we don't like that. We like to think that I'd be happy if things were different. Who's ever thought that before? If things were different, then I'd be happy. If things were different, it starts when we're little, right? If I was bigger, then I'd be happy. If I could stay up later, then I'd be happy, right? And then pretty soon it's, if I was 16, then I'd be happy. That's the, if I could drive. And then it's, if I was graduated, then I'd be happy, right? And then it's, if I was married, then I'd be happy. And then you're like, if I wasn't married, then I'd be happy, right? If we had kids, then I'd be happy. If the kids would move out, then I would be happy, right? If I was retired, if I'd be happy. If I could lose weight, then I'd be happy. If I had a better car, then I'd be happy. I mean, it just keeps going. There's people like, if I were to retire, then I'd be happy. My grandmother, and I'm not joking, my grandmother said to me as she's laying in the nursing home, Hank, if I was dead, she patted my hand, Hank, if I was dead, then I think I'd be happy, right? I'm convinced there's people in the next life who are like, if I was resurrected, then I'd be happy. And it just keeps going. Forever, right? If things were different, then I'd be happy. And I'm here to tell you that if things were different, you would be the exact same. The exact same. So we have got to learn how to be happy when? Now. We have got to learn how to be happy now in our circumstances. By the way, that little red sliver, the only circumstances that make a difference on happiness are number one, poverty level, outside of your control. You cannot get above the poverty level. And illness. Illness where you cannot, you're just always down, you're always sick. Take away those two things and that red little piece of pie almost disappears. Has nothing to do with money, has nothing to do with job, has nothing to do with type of car, right? If we could give everyone a nicer car, we wouldn't change the happiness level at all. Now, I know this is hard to accept, but just take it in for a second and be like, okay, if it has nothing to do with my circumstances, why am I not happier? Well, it has maybe to do with some of those intentional activities. We could do a little bit better on those. I wrote a book called Be Happy, which an entire two chapters are basically on that idea of what are those intentional activities that can make you happier. But we're going to practice one thing. This is Thomas Edison. You know who Thomas Edison is. Thomas Edison has the record for the most patents in the United States Patent Office, right? He still has, I think it's over 1,400 patents in his name. Now, a lot of people say, well, Thomas Edison stole his ideas from Nikola Tesla. That's okay. We don't have to get into that. But I do want to tell you something about Edison that you might not have known. Did you know Edison had this uncanny way of being very positive? He had this uncanny way of spinning his negative experiences into positive ones. I'll give you an example. Did you know when he was 12 years old, he lost 90% of his hearing? It devastated his parents. They thought his life was over. He stopped them. This 12-year-old boy looked at his parents and said, no, don't be upset. It helps me concentrate. That's insane. Did you know when he was in his mid-30s, he was trying to invent the light bulb that would be available to the general public? Well, the light bulb had already been invented, but it was very expensive, and he wanted to make it very cheap, right? And so he might have been taking ideas from anybody he could to try to create this light bulb. And when he tries over, I think it was something like over 1,000 different prototypes, 1,000 different experiments, years of time, he still hasn't done it. A newspaper wrote, I think it was New York Times, says Edison has failed. He has not been able to create this light bulb. He actually wrote in, you probably heard this story, he wrote into the newspaper and said, I have not failed. I have found over 1,000 ways in which it won't work. Try that with your math teacher, right? I did not fail that test. I found a bunch of ways to get those problems wrong, right? Look at that. Do you know when he was in his late 60s, his New Jersey factory burns to the ground? burns to the ground. Late 60s, his son, Charles, came running up to because he heard about the fire, and he's watching his dad's life work burn to the ground. Now, it was $3 million in damages. This is in the early 1900s. $3 million in damage. Did he have insurance? He did, for $250,000. Right? He thought it'd be a little bit more fireproof than it was. So he's watching it burn to the ground. His son came up to him, and he looked at him. He said, my heart broke. There he was, my father, his white hair blowing in the wind, watching his life work burn to the ground. He said, he's not a young man. He can't rebuild all of this in his lifetime, right? He said, but when he saw me, he looked and said, Charles, where is your mother? He said, Father, I don't know. And he said, Charles, go and find your mother. She'll never see a fire like this as long as she lives. Absolutely unbelievable. The next day, the employees show up to see the damage. He calls them all around. You guys, this is a true story. He said, my friends, there is great value in this disaster. All of our mistakes are burned up. Thank heaven we can start anew, right? He had this uncanny way. Maybe it's in his DNA. I don't know. Maybe it's just part of the way he decided to look at life, to find the good and to find good things in life. So here, I thought we'd practice. You're going to practice this. I need you to write it down or put it in your phone, a reminder. You're going to do a little thing, maybe put it up on the mirror, put it up in your bedroom, put it up somewhere where you see it every day. Three little words called accentuate the positive. That's what you're going to do. You're going to find a way to accentuate the positive, make it bigger. You're going to focus on it. Talk about how good those things are. I was listening to a PhD this week. I like to turn my car. I have a little 20-minute drive to work every day, and I like to turn my car into a university. And so I listen to a lot of smart people tell about their subject. And I was listening to a woman who has a degree in shame. It's an interesting thing. She has a degree. She focused her dissertation study on shame and how shame is really not good for us. She said guilt is a good thing. Guilt is about behavior. Shame is about value, right? I feel guilty for what I did versus I hate myself. Do you see the difference? Guilt is a good thing that can propel us forward, but shame, she said, is not a good thing. And so when we start to feel shame, when we start to feel down on ourselves, she said, what we need to do, one of the ways to get out of it, there was many, but one of the ways to get out of it is, she said, you got to practice gratitude. You need to practice gratitude, and fast and quick, and just start listing all the things you're grateful for. So I had an opportunity to try this the other day, just yesterday, because it was my birthday. Happy birthday to me. I actually turned 39, which most people are like, well, what are you really? And I was like, no, I'm really 39. They're like, okay, whatever. I'm like, really? I'm actually turned 39. The one age that, you know, where I have an anniversary from here on out. I realize that, right? It's my second anniversary of turning 39, whatever. But this was my real 39th birthday. And my wife texted me and said she took the truck to Sorensen's Auto Body, and the truck is going to need a couple grand worth of repairs on my birthday. Right? And I was like, oh! And I was kind of frustrated and angry, and I started to get mad at my life and this idea of entering kind of this shame, this poor me type shame. And so what did she say to do? Practice gratitude. So I just started as fast as I could. I was like, I might as well try, right? So I started listing just out loud as I'm driving, because she called me when I was driving, and I started listing all the things I was grateful for. And it didn't take more than a minute before I started to come out of what could have been a day full of just anger. Right? Because this could have ruined my day. But it worked. I was so surprised at how quickly it worked. I just focused on it. I'm grateful that my children are healthy. I'm grateful that I have a spouse who we're connected. We're friends. I'm grateful that we have all of a sudden I started going through. I'm grateful I live in Utah County. I like Utah County. Right? I'm grateful for this. I'm grateful. And all of a sudden I started to come out of it, this practicing gratitude, not just being like, yeah, I'm a grateful person, but just practicing going through it, really kind of brought me out of it. I've had moments where that hasn't worked, though. Well, I shouldn't say it hasn't worked. I've had moments where I didn't do it. Anybody ever just had a bad day and left it as a bad day and let it ruin their day and had something happen? This happened to me once. My wife and I, we moved from Salt Lake County to Utah County. Moving is stressful. It's one of those top, five really stressful experiences for human beings. And as we moved, and you know how it is moving, like people come over to help you move, but they really don't help. They mostly hurt, right? Because they start packing pots and pans with clothes and things. And you're like, what? They're like, yeah, your friends come over and like, goodbye. I just want to get out of here as fast as I can. And then when you move to your new house, then people want to come over and pretend that they're good neighbors. And so they come bring everything inside, but they want to leave. And so they put everything, in the kitchen. Everything is in the kitchen. The one place you don't need everything, it's all in the kitchen. And so I'm in the kitchen and there's boxes and boxes. And you're just like, oh, and the kids are are hungry. You ever had this experience? The kids are, you know, when anybody have kids that get hangry? Anybody have those? Anyone want to point them out? Anybody who's the most hangry kid in this family? My kids were hungry and they're getting upset and fighting with each other. And I'm like, fine, I'll just find anything. What do we have? And I'm going through these boxes and I find the microwave. So I set the microwave on the counter and I'm going to find some hot dogs or something. And as I set the microwave on the counter, my wife says, oh, put that back in the box. We're getting a new microwave. And I said, why are we getting a new microwave? This one works just fine. And she said, it doesn't match. Who here is hoity-toity? And super like, I am so important. All my appliances need to match. Who's here is like that? I cannot believe you. Who here is smart and intelligent and thinks that all of the appliances just need to function? Who here? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, men. We will meet over here for a big group hug afterwards, right? I was like, Sarah, wait, no, we're not getting a new microwave. And so I left it on the counter, and pretty soon she put it back in the box. And I was like, no. So I got it out of the box, plugged it back in. And then pretty soon she put it back in the box and taped the box up. And I was like, no. So I got the box out and untaped it and put it back on there. And pretty soon I found it in the garage, taped up with stuff on top of it. I had to get it out, right? And of course our kids are like, are you guys fighting, right? No, Mom and Dad love each other. One of us is a spender, and the other is a saver. You want to marry a saver, right? Right? Oh, yeah. And my wife's like, some people are Neanderthals. It was bad. But we eventually compromised and decided to get a new microwave. Now, that's a compromise, by the way. There's some teenage boys here like, that's not a compromise. You're not married. So we compromised. It's the same thing with cats. I hate cats. She adores cats. So we compromised and we have two cats. I can't stand cats, really. I just don't like them. I think they should stay where they belong, in the road. Sorry. Some of you are cat people. I'm sorry. I'm sure I'll grow into it. We get the new microwave, I bring it home, and Sarah opens the box, and she looks at it, and she said, what did you buy? And I said, a microwave. And she goes, I didn't ask for a blue one. And I was like, well, and she looked at me, and every husband knows what's about to come. She's like, take it back. I'm like, Sarah, we can just have a blue one, right? She's like, it doesn't match. I'm like, no, just use the old one. And she's like, I sold it. For $5. Some guy came to my house, got my functioning microwave for $5, and he was like, they all have to match, right? Oh, some single guy has my microwave. So I'm like, oh, okay. So now I'm taking it back to the store. Now I'm mad, right? My day's been interfered with, my very important stuff. And anybody, does anybody get dramatic? Anybody irrational? Please tell me there's someone else who's dramatic and irrational in here. Okay, good. I get a little dramatic and irrational. My brain clicks over to angry mode. So I walk back into Home Depot and I throw the microwave on the customer service desk. I basically just, you know, because I want something in there to break. They made me come all the way back here, right? So I just kind of ching, right? And the woman at the desk, she's got to be 19 years old. She's like, hi, right? What can I do for you? I'm like, the microwave's blue. This is stainless steel in the box. The microwave's blue. I need another microwave. She's like, I'm so sorry, sir. Can I see your receipt? Fine. Right? My kids are with me. Good job, Dad. Thank you. Right? So her boss comes over and he's like, what seems to be the problem? Right? And she says, well, he bought this microwave, but it says it's stainless steel, but it's blue. And we need to get another microwave. And he's like, I'm so sorry about that, sir. I'm like, yeah, I bet. Whatever. He goes about 5 steps and he turns and he says, hey, sir. Yeah. He says, did you take the stainless steel cellophane off of the microwave? I said, the what? He said, the blue cellophane, did you take it off of the microwave? And he opened the box and he pulled the blue off of the microwave. Have you ever seen someone trying their hardest not to laugh? It wasn't him, he was totally fine. It was the girl that I had been so mean to. She was like, of course, from down below. Wait, the microwave's not blue. He's like, quiet, please, quiet. Dad, wait, you said these people were idiots. Yeah, I know. I know what I said. Let's go away. I got home. When I got home, guess who else thought it was so funny? Let's see if I can do an impression of my wife. She's like, wait, wait, wait. She was laughing so hard she could only get little tiny fractions of sentences out. You ever done this before? She's like, wait, wait, wait. Okay, tell me again. And then he pulled the blue off. Yeah. You must have felt so dumb. Yeah. Like, Sarah, you thought it was blue. She's like, I know, but yeah, I didn't take it back. This has been years ago. We'll be sitting watching a movie a week ago. We'll be sitting, all of a sudden she'll go, I'm like, what? What's so funny? You thought it was blue. And I noticed something. I learned something that day because I didn't think it was very funny. And I'm looking around like, why does that girl think it's funny? Why does that girl think it's funny? Right? Why does everybody think it's funny and not me? And all of a sudden I realized something, that you cannot be happy and selfish at the same time. Can I say it again? You cannot be happy and selfish at the same time. And that's what I was being. I was selfish with my time. I was selfish with my money. Right? I was being selfish. It was all about me. Have you ever had center of the universe syndrome? Anybody ever had it? Anybody live with someone who has center of the universe syndrome? Let me describe it to you. Center of the universe syndrome is someone who thinks the world revolves around them and that everyone else is just supporting cast in the grand theater of life in which they have the starring role. You can just give that person next to you a little bump with the elbow if you'd like to. Not hard, just enough to bruise. And let them know that sometimes they have center of the universe syndrome. Now, I want to just break in a little bit to what do you do? Some of you are here and you're like, yeah, I've had the bad day thing and I'm really trying to overcome the bad day. But what do you do when life hands you circumstances that you have no choice over and it's hard and it's tragic? Does anybody here, especially you adults, do you remember the day when you thought tragedy would never strike you and your family? Do you remember living that way and it was always somebody else? You're like, oh, that's heartbreaking. And then inside you're kind of like, I'm really glad that's not us, right? But you want to help, you want to serve, you want to, you know, you want to go and help your neighbors. But inside you're like, oh, I'm sure that is not us. Who remembers the day when tragedy first struck your family? Who remembers that day? Either it was either a phone call, news you got, someone came over, right? There was a knock on the door and your world changes. What do you do at those moments? What do you do when life deals you such a hardship that it's not something just to get over, not something to spin, but something you're going to have to live with and deal with for the rest of your life? Everything is permanently changed. What happens then? Well, I think Meg is probably more qualified, obviously, to speak on this, but I want to show you a story that I read recently, and I'm going to finish with this, but it's the story of, anybody read this book, The Boys in the Boat? It's a newer book, but I think this will go on to win the Pulitzer Prize. I'm a big fan of true history, and I think this one will. They're going to make a movie out of it. I think Harry Potter's in it. I don't know his real name. But and here's the story. I won't tell you the whole thing for those of you who, you know, are going to go and read it, because I hope you do. The story is about a kid named Joe Rance. And when Joe Rance is 4 years old, so he's just a little tyke, he's 4 years old, blonde hair, blue eyes. He's living in the early 1900s. He's living up in the Northwest, up by Seattle, which is more of a logging town at this time. His mother dies, which is tragic, right? And takes the most important person of his life, and she's gone. His father can't handle the death of his wife. He's not emotionally equipped to handle it, that and a child. So he puts Joe on a train. So not only has he lost his mother, but his dad sticks him on a train and sends him to the East Coast to live with his mother's sister. All Joe remembers is being 4 or 5 years old and being cared for on the train by a really big African-American man.
She says, all I remember. And he gets there and he has a new mom. He's lost his home. He's lost his brother, who is older. He's lost his dad and his mother. And now he's got a brand new family at 4 and 5 years old. Some of people think, oh, he's too young. Is this going to affect him? Absolutely it will. Guess what? When he's 6 years old, dad is so selfish. I can't get over this sometimes. When he's 6 years old, dad has remarried and decided he wants his son back. So again, for the second time in his life, Joe is ripped away from the woman he calls mother and sent back across the country to come live with people he doesn't even know. It's been 2 years for a six-year-old. He doesn't even know these people much anymore. But it gets even worse for Joe because his new stepmom, her name is Tula, and she has no interest in this boy. None. Because it's the old life. The older son had gone and moved out, and now Joe and her children live together. And she does not like Joe being around her kids. And she doesn't like that Joe is a reminder of her husband's old life. And so she is constantly trying to get rid of him. She sends him to boarding schools. She tries to, you know, farm him out as a worker, right? And he'll live with you over there, and he'll work for you. Constantly trying to get rid of him. And Joe's always trying to figure out why he's not liked. Trying to win her affection. Trying to, you know, Tula, you'll like me if I do this, right? And she never likes him. She never likes him. In fact, it gets so bad that when he's in ninth grade, he is 14 years old. He comes home from school. He was going to school. He comes home from school, and there's the family car is completely packed. And he said to his father, and the kids were in it, and he comes home to his dad, and he says, Dad, where are we going? True story. His father says to him, that's the thing, son. We're going. You're staying. What? Well, your mom's decided I've got to choose between the two of you. And I got to choose her, son. She has all these little kids. So the house is yours. Take good care of yourself. And Joe Rantz sits on the porch of his house as his family drives away. He said it was worse than losing them in death to see the pure rejection of them just driving away. Where are you going? We can't tell you that. They drive away and they go live a couple of hours away while Joe tries to make his way in the world all by himself. And by some miracle, and you can read the book if you'd like to, Joe Rantz ends up on the University of Washington's rowing team. The 1936 rowing team that is supposed to go to Germany and compete in the Olympics, right, and perhaps try to win gold for America. But the team has a problem. It's this kid named Joe Rantz. He's the best rower they've ever had in the history of the sport. This kid is so strong. He learned to make it on his own. It's been 5 years he's been on his own, and he has learned to do things on his own. But he won't row with the rest of the team. He's not good with the team. He likes them, and they like him, but he's not connecting. And so coach pulls him aside, and he says, Joe, what's the problem? It says this, the book. He told Joe that there were times when he seemed to think he was the only fellow in the boat. When a man rowed like that, he said, he was bound to attack the water rather than work with it. And worse, he was bound to not let his crew help him row. Does that make sense? Are you seeing why? And we do that in life when we've been hurt. We say, I'm going to make it on my own. He told Joe to be careful not to miss his chance. He reminded him he had already learned to row past pain, past exhaustion, past the voice that told him it couldn't be done. And you've already done that. You have lived past pain. You have lived past exhaustion. You've lived past the voice that told you you couldn't go any further. You're still here. You're still standing. And then he concluded with a remark that Joe would never forget. And it's this. Joe, when you really start trusting those other boys, you will feel a power at work within you that is far beyond anything you've ever imagined. It's the idea that I'm not going to just get through my trials. I'm not going to be conquered by them either. I refuse to be changed. I refuse to let my goodness let go. I refuse to let my belief in people, right? My belief that people can love me. My belief that people can be trusted again, right? Well, Joe breaks down with his coach, and it's an interesting moment where he says to his coach, Coach, you can't trust other people. You can't trust other people. You got to do it yourself because everybody leaves. You have to do it alone. And his coach grabs, he's just this little guy. He grabs this big rower, and the big rower, Joe Rantz, just starts crying, right? He has this release of all this energy. He puts his head on his shoulder and he says, Joe, that's where you're wrong, Joe. That's where you're wrong. These boys love you and they're going to take good care of you. Well, I won't tell you what happens, but I will tell you this. And why would they make a book out of it? It really doesn't end well.
right? Just so you know. Joe Rance finds far more than winning a race, right? He finds what you and I both need to find, which is, I will not be conquered by my trials. I'll get through them, yes, but I refuse to be made bitter by them. I won't let that happen. I need to wrap up. We got to get to the real speakers. So let me just finish with this. One of my other favorite books is Man's Search for Meaning. Anybody read it? If you haven't read this one, I'd add this one to your list as well. It's about a man named Viktor Frankl who finds himself in a Jewish concentration camp. He has a PhD. He's a brilliant psychologist. But yeah, here he is in a concentration camp working basically slave labor. How, you know? And if you know the story of World War II, you know how that happened to him. And he has to decide if he's going to survive. He has to decide if he's going to make it. And he does, and he ends up writing this book. And this is one of the things he wrote in his book, among many great things. Here's what he writes. And I hope you'll believe this. Even the helpless victim of a hopeless situation, that might be you. When you see Meg, you're going to see at one point in her life, she was a helpless victim of a hopeless situation. But what happened? He may rise above himself. He may grow beyond himself, and by so doing, change himself. He may turn personal tragedy into triumph. That's my hope and my prayer for you, that you will take your personal tragedies, whatever they are, big or small, and decide they're going to be triumphs of your life, that your story is not over, that you are going to make something great out of something very, very difficult. Thank you so much for coming, my friends. I'm going to give the microphone back to Mark. Oh, goodness.
Thank you for listening to A Determined Soul, Finding Laughter in Trials by Hank Smith. From all of us here at Jumping Turtle, we wish you the very best. You can learn more about our live events, products, and services at www.jumpingturtle.net.